Welcome to the Security Perimeter, an apocalyptic podcast, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulas. This is an awesome podcast, the best, guaranteed, 100%. We'll make Perimeter Podcast great again. My name is Lambro Christoulas, your announcer. And now, to my dad, Athanasios Christoulas, a.k.a. Saki.
So, welcome back for the latest episode of the Security Perimeter Podcast. And today we have Alan Burson. Alan Burson, of course, being the former Undersecretary for Homeland Security, in charge of borders and international affairs, from what I understand. Alan, this is Alan's third podcast with us, and I'm really, really grateful to him for doing this. This time he's back to talk about the migrant crisis that's taking place as we speak at the border between Mexico and the United States, specifically in the area of Tijuana. And we decided to do this kind of like a live broadcast, a live podcast with students present. And so what Alan did was he sort of gave some initial thoughts about how he felt about the issue, and then we switched to comments, questions, answer period, and it turned out really, really cool. I'm not going to edit it. I'm just going to put it up the way it is so I can get it up as soon as possible, and also you'll get that kind of live effect from the podcast. So I won't say much more other than to say that please, if you are enjoying the podcast and like it, to, you know, give it a 5-star review or 5-6-star review. Don't give it a lower than a 5-star review, but give it a 5-star review because I know people are listening to it, but the thing is, they just listen to it. They don't, you know, put a review or they don't do anything like that. And when you review these things, it's not only to make me happy or upset if you put like a 1-star review or something like that, but it's when you put these 5-star reviews, it helps in the rankings of the podcast in terms of the platform. So, you know, the more 5-star reviews that a podcast has, the higher it's ranked in its particular category, mine being news and politics. So, you know, wherever you're listening to the podcast, in Spotify or iTunes or even directly at the page, just give it a review, you know, especially a 5-star review. The other thing that I want to mention is don't forget to drop by the podcast webpage, which is called securityperimeter.com. Actually, it's not called securityperimeter.com. It's the direction. I've been living in Mexico too long. The address for the website is thesecurityperimeter.com. And you can find the episodes there, but you can also find some other fun stuff like Russian fake news and Washington fake news, but especially Russian fake news. Without further ado, let's go right into the podcast. And don't forget those 5-star reviews. And don't forget to visit the podcast webpage at thesecurityperimeter.com.
So thank you for all taking the time out to do this. This is actually a very critical period, not only porque AMLO va a empezar el sábado, but because we're in a huge transition having to do with migration and border events. So I'm really eager to try out some thoughts with you, and I'm always happy to be at ETOM, and I have a lot of regard for you, because yo puedo hablar el español, pero como un estudiante del tercer nivel. Ustedes hablan el inglés con el vocabulario académico que se necesita tener para aprender. Y discúlpame, yo voy a hablar en el inglés con Saki.
He always says that I don't speak Spanish, but then he always seems to find the right Spanish word. Do you want to say some opening words?
Yeah. So about
the whole.
Yeah. So
Tijuana
why? I've been involved in the border for 25 years. I started como el fiscal federal en San Diego. And it was really during the Clinton-Cedillo years, durante los años 90, when Mexico and the United States began to start to cooperate. The underlying fact was the economic integration that was starting to take place because of TLC that was passed in 1994 and that completely revolutionized our relationship economically. And you don't have to be a Marxist to appreciate that what the peso and the dollar construct together becomes a basis for many other phenomena. And one of them was that the in terms of security, border security, the United States and Mexico started to cooperate in a way that had never, ever been the case. And that has continued steadily through the Bush-Fox years, through the Calderón-Bush, Calderón-Obama, Obama-Peña Nieto years. And then we have this election of Trump, for reasons I'm happy to explore in terms of questions, but it's a populism of the right that is actually taking place all over the world, not only in Brazil, in Hungary, in China, in a certain sense. And now we're going to see actually the transition to a left-leaning populism with AMLO, and we're going to see what we saw on the weekend hopefully is not this beginning of a collision between López Obrador and Trump in migration, and was more a function of the fact that estamos en el medio entre las administraciones mexicanas y no había ninguno fue encargado en el lado mexicano, porque teníamos por 20 años un plan, una estrategia de cooperación en la frontera para evitar la violencia, para evitar lo que ha pasado el domingo. Había un vacuum, because nobody was in charge. And then we saw what happened, which was for the first time in many, many, many years, we saw tear gas being used by the Border Patrol. And I was the head of the Border Patrol, but I am also their fiercest critic. I was the first one 25 years ago as a prosecutor to put Border Patrol agents in jail for abusing Mexican migrants. But I am also a firm believer in the rule of law. You cannot permit hundreds of migrants to go rushing hacia la frontera. So that from my perspective, when the word was given to Mexican federal police not to stop the migrants, and the migrants started to throw stones and rocks across the border, me parece que el uso de tear gas fue una decisión que I would have taken myself. So if you have a problem with that, challenge. But let's actually understand what are the issues. But the fact of the matter is that that vacuum is what caused the escalation. And what we hope will happen starting Saturday is that there will again be a recognition that no se puede manejar la frontera de un lado, de un solo lado. Sin la cooperación, sería un mess of large proportion. So that would be the introduction of where I think we want to go, because we're actually also in a huge period of transition, not only Trump in terms of U.S. politics, but also in terms of Mexican politics, because Mexico still, with all due respect, and I have great respect and love for your country, with all due respect, Mexico still thinks of itself as a sending country, that migrants, it's a country that sends migrants. That's not the case. More Mexicans are leaving the United States voluntarily and involuntarily every year now than are actually entering the United States. Mexico has the 13th largest economy in the world. The OECD predicts that in one generation, when you are my age, We're almost there. Mexico will
when
have
they're my age, actually.
Mexico will have a larger economy than Germany. Tendrá la economía cuatro más grande en el mundo dentro de 30 años. Mexico is no longer an impoverished, undemocratic society. You have many issues to deal with the way my society does in the United States with inequality, and there's no question. But the fact of the matter is Mexico is a major world power, and you cannot permit thousands of people to march through your country in a lawless way. But the perspective of Mexican law at this juncture is still immigration law es un asunto de derechos humanos. Y no tiene nada que ver con el estado del derecho. Y con respeto, este es el cambio de su generación. Tiene que investigar y habrá cambios. So you have this period of great change in Mexico and the United States. So that, in fact, the problem in the United States today, contrary to President Trump's constant rhetoric, is not that the border is not secure. The border was not secure 25 years ago when I started in Tijuana, San Diego. That's not the case today. Since the 1990s, the United States has invested $18 billion, 18 billones de dólares el año. La patrulla fronteriza fue una fuerza de 3,000 agentes en los años 90. Hoy hay 22,000 agentes de la patrulla fronteriza. The border has more technology, it has more surveillance. And frankly, many, many fewer people are entering the country illegally than was the case 10 years ago. So that the problem at the border, contrary to Trump, is not security. The problem is that our immigration system is completely broken. And the part that is most broken is the one that has to do with the granting of political asylum. Why are thousands of people coming from the Northern Triangle? Hondureños, Guatemaltecos, Salvadoreños. Why are they marching through Mexico in caravans? It's because they can get into the United States legally by coming to the border, and they don't try to avoid the Border Patrol anymore. This is not about sneaking across the La Línea. They look for the Border Patrol so that they can claim asylum. And when they claim asylum, they have to go through what's called a credible fear test. Es un examen muy básico, con un estándar muy bajo. Credible fear. 80% of the people who are examined for credible fear pass the test. Once you pass the test, 80% está pasando. You have the right to then go in front of an immigration judge and have your full petition for asylum heard. The problem is, the immigration courts are so broken, they are so backlogged. Hay 700,000 casos esperando un juez. 700,000 cases. Which means that people get paroled into the United States, and they wait for 2, 3, or 4 years for hearings. Many never go to the hearings, but the fact of the matter is, once they're in the United States, they have jobs, they have children, they have relatives, they establish a base in the United States, and it is not so easy or fair to then deport them back to Guatemala because, or Honduras, or Salvador. But 70% of the people who actually go in front of a judge are turned down. Their petitions for asylum are rejected. So you have this very weird situation. 80% are brought into the country. When they go to a hearing, 70% are then deported. But you have a situation that is totally broken and out of control. But that's why people keep coming. The smugglers are able to say, I can get you into the United States. ¿Vas a pagarme 12,000 dólares? Yo voy a arreglar una petición para el asilo. That's why the people have been coming. Now, the question that is not being asked, if you look at the news reports, is how did 12,000 people get from the Northern Triangle countries to Tijuana? A better question, how did they get when they were on the road, caminando por pie, el pie? How did they get from 1,300 miles away from the border to Mexico City very quickly, and then within 4 or 5 days get to Tijuana? Así que tenemos ahora 10,000 personas in Tijuana applying for asylum, but only being able to do it 100 a day, because that's all that CBP is processing every day. But how did we get from the highway in Veracruz to California? And why California and not Arizona or Texas or New Mexico? This is the part of the equation that is most difficult for me to talk to my colleagues and friends in Mexico. But this is the reflective of what has happened in Mexico. When you think of immigration and migration, is always a question of human rights. So that the idea is, we are going to help these people make their way to the border, because we are going to support the migrants, because that is our tradition and that is our perspective. So that you have advocacy groups, church groups, local and state governments in Mexico, everybody is helping the migrants move to the border. But that's why it is no longer viable. Because Mexico cannot, in my view and respectfully, ignore the law, not have a sophisticated asylum system itself, not be able to give people refuge in a country of 125 million people with the wealth and the creativity and the talent that exists here, cannot create work law, work rights for people, but in an orderly way. This notion is, we need 100,000 jobs in Mexico. Well, is that going to be, you're going to just open the borders and say everybody who wants to come across should come across, regardless of who you are, where you're coming, or why you're coming? That's been the case up until very recently, when there's been a plan para la frontera sureña aquí en México. And the fact of the matter is that Mexico was arresting more Central Americans in the last 3 years, 250,000 cada año, than the United States was arresting on its southwest border. But the discussion was never had by the Peña Nieto administration, frankly, with the Mexican people, to say, this is the new world we live in. We need to develop a new system of immigration, a new system of asylum, so that we can actually be fair to people, but also maintain the rule of law. The tragedy that's going on now is that we have 10,000 people in Tijuana, and you cannot distinguish between those that are genuinely entitled to humanitarian relief, who genuinely deserve refugee status. You cannot distinguish them from the mass of people who are actually economic migrants for good reason. No hay ninguna oportunidad para el empleo en Honduras. Hay mucha violencia, mucha pobreza. But the fact of the matter is that the asylum system was not designed to redress every human misfortune that exists in the world. But you have to have a system that actually addresses people who need humanitarian relief. So that's the challenge. That's the situation that we find ourselves in. We're in between two worlds, and the people who are suffering the most and who are being exploited the most are the very migrants who everyone claims to be protecting. Why don't I stop there and open it up to some questions?
Let me ask you something, Alan. Let me start off with the questions. So what would you do with the tens of thousands of people that are interested or want to, for economic reasons or for other reasons, that want to go to the United States and generally make a positive contribution to the U.S. economy, pay their taxes, et cetera? I mean, what should be done on the part of the U.S. to address this issue?
So let me, it's both the United States and Mexico, because I think one of the big changes is that we can no longer pretend that we're operating in dual parallel fashion. We cannot pretend that what happens in Mexico doesn't affect the United States and vice versa. But the fact of the matter is that there should be two things need to be done. There needs to be a work-based migration reform. The fact is that there are H-2A visas, agricultural visas. There are an unlimited number of them, but we need to have a system that actually gets them to the people that need and want to work in the agrarian sector. On the Mexican side, there are many, many jobs that are needed here that could be filled by Central American hardworking, decent Central American individuals. But you need to have a system that identifies them. INAME and Mexican immigration, there is no system right now. That has to be developed. With regard to humanitarian relief, I think the new administration has been resisting something called a Safe Third Country Agreement. What the Safe Third Country Agreement is an agreement that says if you enter Mexico and you do not claim asylum, you cannot continue on to the United States and claim asylum there. You would be returned to your home country and deported because you did not take advantage of the opportunity to claim asylum in Mexico. Many Mexican observers oppose that because Mexico is not yet in a position to actually process that number of claimants. What I think the concern was is that we don't want people waiting for asylum for their petitions to be decided either from the United States or Mexico. We do not want large camps of Central American refugees in Mexico. That's a perfectly reasonable position for Mexican officials and the Mexican people to take. We don't want refugee camps in Mexico. So the subject, I think what could be done is, in addition to the Safe Third Country Agreement, you would create zonas de seguridad in Honduras, Guatemala, and Honduras, in Salvador, El Salvador. And in those safe zones, people who genuinely were afraid for their lives would be able to come to the safe zone and claim asylum, either in Mexico, the United States, or in Costa Rica, or in Brazil, or in Canada. But there would be a place where they would do it in a protected place, una zona protegida.
Inside Mexican territory?
No. In the sending countries, in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador.
I mean, the governments wouldn't.
No, but this is not their. See, this is part of the problem. Is those governments? Many people consider them failed states, and they may well be. They are dumping the problem into the lap of Mexico and the United States. It seems to me that Mexico and the United States could insist that these safe zones be established, that they be administered by UNHCR, the Human Rights and Refugee Committee of the UN, or the International Migration Organization, the IOM, that they would be maintained and that people would have a opportunity to claim asylum in any of the countries, and their petitions would be processed. In the meantime, they'd be protected, and they would be clothed and fed and so on. Now, I think the reason that works together with the Safe Third Country is that the word would get back very quickly in the communities of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador that you cannot that you can no longer just march through Mexico, end up in the United States, enter the United States, and wait there for your petition to be adjudicated. Once you created that system with safe zones and the safe third country, in my view, you would actually see a huge deterrent, but also it would leave a space for those who were genuinely in need of refugee status and asylum status. They'd have an opportunity to pursue it. Most people who were simply going, wanted to go to Mexico, the United States for economic reasons, would not stay in a safe zone for 6 months to a year, not being able to go back and forth. So I think there's a solution here if we work together, and one that would deal with the basic problems of how do we distinguish between genuine asylees or refugees and those who are economic migrants, and how do we actually provide for a process that gets heard quickly and fairly, but people actually have to wait in a protected zone in their own countries while that's happening.
Alan, it sounds like a great idea, but how likely do you think something like that can occur given the political context in the United States and Mexico and even Central America, where you do have populist regimes that kind of resist these mechanisms of cooperation?
It seems to me that that proposal put forward by a López Obrador administration would be a big challenge to the Trump policies that really are rhetorical and political rather than addressing the actual factors that a policy of the kind I've described would address. It would provide humanitarian relief for those who are entitled to it, protection for those who need it, and a fair and expedited process to have the petition adjudicated. I think that should be, with all due respect, what Mexico should want in terms of developing its own system of migration, and to do so in a way that would be protected. But this involves a huge transition away from the mentality of a sending country in which anything goes, where the rule of law doesn't matter, and where all we're concerned about is a form of human rights that, frankly, I don't believe are being enjoyed by the people who are now sitting in those squalid camps outside of Tijuana in Baja California.
Do you want to say something about DACA?
Yeah. Well, I'm delighted. When I was last here and met ETOM students, the lawsuit had just been filed by the University of California and Janet Napolitano. Last year, it was the ruling was issued by the district court in San Francisco upholding the claim that DACA could not be rescinded by the Trump administration the way it did, and the 700,000 Dreamers were given a renewed stay of deportation. Very recently, the Court of Appeal ruled and affirmed the decision of the district court, again giving the Dreamers continued status in the United States. Now the government has appealed it to the Supreme Court, which, if you've been following the politics of Supreme Court appointments in the United States, now for the first time in many years has a solidly conservative majority, so that the appeal to the Supreme Court, which will be heard in the next year or so, is going to be a much more difficult case to make than had been the case in the Bay Area and San Francisco District Court or in the Ninth Circuit, which includes California. Having said that, I believe that there are justices on the Supreme Court, including the Chief Justice, although they are conservative, will find it very difficult not to respond to the law as it has affected the Dreamers. And as was the case in the last major immigration case that came before the Supreme Court, it was decided in a way that was not predicted by those who thought there would be a knee-jerk reaction both from the left and the right wings of the court. So it's going to be a more difficult case to make, But me parece que hay un chance.
Okay, can I ask you another thing that you had brought up last time you were here, which was this idea of a new North America, a much more integrated North America, and this was in the more or less the beginning of the Trump administration, and you were optimistic that this could actually happen, that the three countries in North America could come together to form something special, something different. Are you still optimistic about that?
So,
or even more now?
A year ago, my wife says correctly about me, he's often wrong, but never uncertain. But I don't know many things, but I do know the border, and I do know North American borders in particular, and Mexico and Canada as a U.S. observer. So everyone predicted that NAFTA was TLSA was going out the window. When I was last here, no one thought, when I said I thought there would be a new agreement and that it would be an agreement that was necessary and would be an updating of the original NAFTA, TLSA, people thought that Trump would never let that happen. What President Trump discovered was that, in fact, the facts on the ground, los hechos en el suelo, the ties that we have in a shared production platform that is a massive industrial machine across the three countries, not only in the automobile sector, but in others, that accounts for now the three countries, the three core countries of North America account for about 30% of the global product, just under 20% of all of world trade takes place among the three countries. $1.3 trillion U.S. dollars a year in trade. When President Trump heard, and the farmers in Kansas realized that they were selling all of their corn to Mexico, when the farmers in Nebraska realized that most of their soybean crop was being purchased in Mexico, and that their wheat crop of North Dakota was being purchased in Mexico, people were not so eager to scrap NAFTA. As a result, we have the U.S.-Mexico Canada agreement, the USMCA agreement, or in, I guess in Mexico they call it TMEC. In any case, the fact of the matter is that we saw this this centrifugal force suddenly was contained by practical reality. I think in the next year, and we'll know this, because if we don't resolve this situation at the Tijuana-San Diego border cooperatively, if AMLO and Trump and their governments don't resolve this in a sensible way, we could have a year or two of lots of rhetoric and lots of things that are not pleasant. But I predict again, at the end of the day, los hechos en el suelo, los lazos que existen entre los pueblos, la plataforma de producción compartida, these are realities that nobody, ni AMLO ni Trump, are going to be able to deny. We are todos somos norteamericanos. In fact, it is very important for your generation not to let the gringos claim el título de norteamericanos. Todos somos norteamericanos. Y el futuro, su futuro, con respeto, como el futuro, el porvenir de mis nietos y hijos, depende en el América del Norte. Quizás, como ha dicho Castaneda, tienen un corazón latino, pero una cartera puramente norteamericana.
Rodrigo has a question. I got one more before I let Rodrigo take over. But how do you, if you had a crystal ball and you could look forward into the next couple of years on how López Obrador and Trump are going to get along, what would be your best guess? Problematic, risky?
I think there's a certain number of risks. I also think, though, as matters of political personalities, they're actually quite similar. Mm-hmm. They're both authoritarian. They both want central power. They both are not terribly patient with democracy and the problems of democracy. In that respect, and in those terms, there is a certain amount of confluence. But the ideologies are different. One comes from the left, the other comes from the right. One hopes that they will find common ground. But I think we should be prepared for a rocky year or two. But we've lived through this. North America, unlike Europe, which is now really finding itself coming apart at the seams because of the same pressures of migration and Brexit, which was basically a reaction to migration. The European Union was a treaty negotiated and designed by bureaucrats. 27 nations bureaucratically run out of Brussels is not the way North America developed. We still have our separate sovereignties. And basically, the governments have had very little to do with the emergence of North America. It's basically a question of business, a question of non-governmental organizations, a question of people voting with their feet that have actually created the North America that's emerging. So I have great confidence that a pesar de los líderes, el futuro ya se queda América del Norte. Pero es una América del Norte mucho más grande que los tres países de Canadá, México y los Estados Unidos. Extiende de Colombia hasta el Ártico y en el este de Bermuda hasta Hawaii en el oeste. Este es el bloque que va a traernos seguridad mejorada y también prosperidad por todos. Remember, Mexico now, as I said, is the 13th largest economy on its way to being the fourth largest. 45% to 50% of Mexicans are middle class. That took 40 years. Starting with the opening up of the Mexican economy under NAFTA. Central America, we need a Marshall Plan. Abroad is correct. We need a Marshall Plan for Central America. But that's going to take 40 years in order to see Central American people being given the opportunities that Mexicans grabbed with both hands. But if we work together, it can take less time. But you're going to have to see a massive reorganization. All of the low-cost manufacturing de las maquiladoras en el norte, they should be relocated, in my view, to the south. As Mexican manufacturing gets very high-tech, the low-cost textile manufacturing and other low-cost assembly work should be moved for providing opportunities not only in the Northern Triangle, but also in Chiapas, Tabasco, where there needs to be economic development. President López Obrador, absolutely right. But it isn't going to happen the way it happened in the European Union. There aren't going to be huge funds for development. This has got to be a question of business and non-governmental organizations making this happen.
Rodrigo?
Thank you, Alan, for visiting us. I always learn a lot from hearing you. And it's always helpful to have a different perspective on our situation and imagine that Mexico will be the fourth largest economy and so on, things that I rarely think about. I do want to push back on a couple of things. The first one is technical. Is it really necessary to use tear gas on the border, especially given that there are lots of children present as well? That's my first question, and the second question has to do with the framing. I think what you're suggesting is that we should think of this issue as a problem of the rule of law, and not simply as an issue of human rights. However, it seems to me that the rule of law is a rather empty concept. I mean, that there was a rule of law, I suppose, in Nazi Germany, or Bolsonaro might impose some kind of rule of law. I mean, it's not an unqualified good. It's something good, absolutely, that we should strive for, the rule of law, but it doesn't say exactly the content. And so it sounds very persuasive, but in the end, the rule of law might be all kinds of things. But especially, it seems to me that not even European countries are able to sustain their rule of law, because there are just thousands of people crossing the Mediterranean the same way that they're crossing into Mexico. So we might say the rule of law is you can't just simply open the borders, right? And so you have to shut them off. But with so many people, you know, literally trying to break down the barriers, it's a prudential question what you're supposed to do, right? And so you saying, well, you have to respect the rule of law really doesn't help very much. So I don't think that framing is very helpful. It seems to me that if it's not an issue of human rights or a humanitarian issue, then I don't know what it is. And that also absolves the United States of its historical responsibility for the mess that it created in Central America. Yeah. I mean, rather than framing it as rule of law versus human rights, I mean, we have to think globally and historically, and I think the more promising option is to think about the Global Pact for Organized Migration, where the countries assume their responsibility together.
Okay. Two very good questions. Let me start with the more philosophical and strategic one, the second one. So when I say rule of law, I'm not talking about a formal, empty set of legalities. For me, rule of law always incorporates elements of justice, so that it's not, and for me, rule of law encompasses human rights. It has to include that, a rule of law that does not take into account humanitarian needs and refugee needs and human rights is the law of Nazi Germany. That's not the rule of law that I'm talking about. This is a rule of law that actually is accountable to democratic governance and has to be held accountable to see that it's fair and the like. So Rodrigo, the idea that framing it in terms of solely human rights, as opposed to the idea of stability, order, respect for the law, strikes me as the mistake. And I think you can frame the rule of law in a way that encompasses and has to encompass both justice and order and stability. I'm not interested in the order of a graveyard. That'd be the best, if you want total stability and order, right, you turn to an authoritarian, or you turn to a cemetery. I think that no question that you, for me, rule of law, el estado del derecho, is both order, respect for the law, but also incorporates human rights. With regard to the and you cannot throw up your hands and say, well, we have to have open borders. No, we have to work to create systems that incorporate justice and order and stability and respect for orderly processing. On the first question, and this is both of them are really important questions. So remember what I said. First of all, the reports, I can assure you, as the former head of CBP and having checked it and verified it, there were no rubber bullets. What was happening was the tear gas canisters struck. That's what people, and it wasn't many, but that's what was hitting people. There were no bullets being fired, no rubber bullets. The question of tear gas, though, as I said, was that tear gas, there is a use of force policy that is very graduated, right? I was one who supported the use of giving the officers tear gas, because I didn't want them doing what happened so often in the past. So they take out their firearms, and then say we're under attack and start firing and killing people, which frankly there were many, many Mexicans over the course of years who were shot. Arguably they were throwing rocks at agents or they were threatening agents, but the fact is it was not a successful situation. So we actually worked out this whole series of agreements with Mexican authorities to say the use of force at the border is not acceptable, but we have to create conditions of order, and we do that through cooperation, that prevent the situation from escalating to the point or degenerating into the point where the force is escalated. And what did that mean? That meant that Mexican police, local and Policía Federal, and ENAME, and Grupo Beta would actually keep people from actually throwing rocks, running to the border in a chaotic fashion. And for many years, that actually provided a sound way to ensure that the border was a place where agents could not use force and in fact were prosecuted, but also that there would be an order. What happened on Sunday was that broke down. That broke down, and when whoever was agitating the migrants to run to the border, they came up to the line of Mexican federal police, and the Mexican federal police had been ordered not to do anything. People started running to the border, throwing rocks at agents, and the decision was made tactically that in order to prevent a further escalation that could lead to real violence and damage, that tear gas would be used. And I would only point out in defense of that decision tactically is that nobody was hurt, nobody was killed, and the situation was resolved. But if you ask me now, if you go to, you look at the situation in Tijuana, there are 300 Policía Federal who are surrounding the camp in Tijuana to see to it that migrants don't rush the border. Now, I hope that's not only to prevent something happening on Inauguration Day, and that it continues to be the situation on Sunday and Monday after the installation of President López Obrador. But the fact of the matter is, I believe the response with tear gas, as unfortunate as it was actually proportionate, and the proof is in the pudding. The situation was resolved. Nobody was killed, which might not have been the case if people started scrambling over the wall or through the cracks or under the fence and then confronted Border Patrol agents. And then we'd be back to where we were, where every incident of violence became a major source of dissension between Mexico and the United States for good reason. Mexicans don't like to see their fellow citizens being shot. And under U.S. law, Border Patrol agents have the right to self-defense and to use their firearms. And under their training, they were justified, and there were always investigations by the FBI and so on, but many of those were not satisfactory to Mexican authorities or the Mexican people. So the best thing, Rodrigo, is don't let it get to the point of escalation.
The other thing, Alan, is when I hear 500 people running towards the border throwing rocks, it sounds like there were. It seemed to have been organized in some fashion. And throwing rocks into the country that you want to migrate into for some reason, to me, doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. I mean, if you want to be accepted into the United States, the last thing you would want to do is throw rocks at the guys who are in theory going to let you get into the country.
So that's a question that goes back to the issue that I raised, which is something we've always tended to turn our eyes from. So how did 10,000 Central American migrants get from Mexico City to Tijuana in 4 or 5 days? Who paid for the buses? Who paid for the food? Who paid for it? And with all due respect, I'm not going to speculate, but I can tell you that there are only three groups that benefited from the chaos we saw on Sunday. The first are left-leaning advocacy groups that wanted to create a confrontation between the Trump administration and migrants. And they did achieve that, but they handed a huge political victory to Trump in the course of doing that. The second group would be the cartels and the criminal Las Pandillas that would like to see a big split between Mexican and U.S. governments so that there isn't the kind of cooperation that has existed between our law enforcement. And the third group are forces in the sending countries, in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, that actually don't mind pushing people out of their country, dropping the problem into the lap of Mexico and the United States. And frankly, those governments shouldn't be permitted to get away with doing nothing, which is why I advocate for the safe zone. But the fact of the matter is that there was a if in fact the interest of migrants was really what was at stake here, the United States, under its law, processes people at the ports of entry. Instead of bringing 10,000 people to Tijuana, if you had brought people along the 46 ports of entry that exist from Matamoros hasta Tijuana, from Brownsville to San Diego, those people would have been processed in due course, and you wouldn't have had it. So, in fact, there was
the concentration interest. Itself. There's some kind of
there was an interest there. In creating a reaction. Now, we're getting reactions we didn't expect. There's a video that brought tears to my eyes of a Honduran boy, a teenager, who climbed the wall, was starting to go over the wall, and it's the people of Tijuana were acting like the people in Ohio with the hatred and the anger, and they pulled this young man down from the wall, and they started, and he just stood there like this. And they were hitting him with their fists and punching him in the face. And you say to yourself, ¿qué tenemos? What are we doing here? That's what we want to avoid. But the groups that actually are behind the caravans, and frankly, this is part of this whole, the human rights culture that attaches to migration, because I suspect that there were local governments involved, state governments involved, NGO groups involved, church groups involved, all in the name of doing good by migrants, but the result is not so good for migrants.
Well, what's the alternative?
The alternative, I think, Rodrigo, is to have a system of claiming asylum that can be handled in a orderly, rational way, and that would be properly financed. The policies that my government has been following, sending troops to the border, zero tolerance, birthright citizenship, those are all intended only to achieve a political effect, not to actually address the factors that attend to it. But the same thing is true right now in Mexico. What is anyone addressing the underlying real issues that attend to migrants? And we can't say, well, just let them come, although many people in Mexico still feel that way. I just suggest that's why we're in this period of transition that is not such an easy one.
Okay, so we'll look to. I think it's Putin, by the way, who's behind all this. But Costa, why don't you go first?
Thank you for being here. That's the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing I wanted to say, it's a two-part question. If the situation keeps escalating, and for some reason the cooperation is still absent, where do you paint the line? Like, what is the United States willing to do, and will they take responsibility for that?
I think you will see changes in the United States asylum law that will, whether it can be passed now by a Democratic House, is doubtful. So I think you'll see decisions taken that will very carefully limit the number of people who can come through and claim asylum on any particular day. It's now 100 a day in San Ysidro. Maybe they increase it slightly. But you cannot then you end up with a situation with thousands of people if the caravans are continued to come north through Mexico. You have thousands of people on Mexican territory. That's a question that the Mexican government will have to address. There are people who say, once it becomes clear that people can't get into the United States, the way it was happening, that the flows will stop. I actually have some doubts there. I think the situation in Central America is so desperate. The poverty is so unremitting. The violence is so extraordinary. That, in fact, people will march with their feet. That it could not be worse, and that you'll see people starting to come and claiming asylum in Mexico in much greater numbers. So I think if we don't see the cooperation, you're going to see unilateral changes in U.S. immigration policy that will have very dramatic effects on conditions in Mexico.
Alan?
Yeah.
And could you speak up so it could pick you up, so the microphone can pick you up?
Alan, we've seen the reports of private immigration detention centers along the border, Texas, you know, New Mexico, Arizona. Children being separated from their parents and put in terrible conditions in separate detention centers, for-profit detention centers. You know, what are your thoughts on these issues?
Yeah, so obviously even our president was persuaded that separating children from their families was both inhumane and ineffective. I wouldn't focus so much on the private nature of facilities. They're actually, having been there and watched them, and they're you wouldn't want to spend a long time there, but they're not not what we see in the outskirts of Tijuana today. I mean, they actually have developed over the course of the last number of decades, and they are safe and they are clean and there's health care. They're not places you want to stay, but it's not a question of people being mistreated, with the exception that the policy of separating children from their parents was unacceptable. That was the first time that I actually joined with several hundred other U.S. attorneys, former U.S. attorneys, to actually write a letter and say, you know, this is intolerable. And then the administration reversed itself. But the conditions of detention are actually, they're detention, but they're not, abusive.
Thank you for coming. My question might be a little idealist, but you have mentioned multiple times that we cannot just open our borders, and it's not a question just for the United States, but also for Mexico. And the question is, if most recent scientific research has shown that actually migrants improve the economic situation of a country, and they do not represent a threat to national security, and all these factors, why can't we, like, you have mentioned the problems of just receiving a lot of migrants and having them in refugee camps, and we cannot receive economic migrants, just maybe like people migrating for security issues. Why cannot we just let them in and register them in an orderly fashion?
So you can. I don't. My country was built by immigrants. My grandparents are immigrants. They're most of the Western United States and six major sectors were built by Mexicans, you know, who are now Mexican Americans. So this is, you're exactly right. Immigrants build economies. Mexico needs to actually build a system. The question though is whether you just open it up, and there's no reason to just open it up if you have a rule of law that builds in economic needs, labor needs, social justice needs. But the bottom line answer to your question, as an idealist myself, is that at the end of the day, you get reactions from people in the country reacting against it. And that's what's happening now in Tijuana. That's what's happening in Germany. The theory of Angela Merkel, with all due respect, was, look, we have the fourth largest economy in the world, and we don't have enough workers. And I think the idea of some people in Germany was, all of these people coming from the Middle East could actually help build our labor force. And the result, a million people came into Germany, just came into Germany without knowing who they were, what they were. And you had two or three or four or five incidents in Cologne, in Bonn, in Berlin, in Hanover. And suddenly, Angela Merkel is on her way out. politically. And you've seen the same thing happen in Hungary with Orban, the same thing happened in the United States with Trump, the same thing happened in Brazil with Bolsonaro, and you saw the Brexit, which actually had very little to do with immigration. But if you ask the people who voted against, who voted to leave the European Union, 90% of them thought they were doing it for immigration reasons. So for me, the answer is you can do it that way until you get a reaction that actually then creates a situation that's a lot worse.
He's got fast pursuit, so.
So, like, the only reason not for doing it, then, it's because of the political cost of xenophobia within the
population? No, it's also because part of the reason you get that is it's not a majority of migrants by any chance, by any means, but you do have criminals coming in. You do have people who then wreak havoc in communities, and then you get the ability of people who want to do this to pull out and say all of these people were murdered by unlawful migrants. People say, who checked who they were? And you say, well, you know, it's a very small number. Well, if your brother is killed by an illegal migrant, you don't feel that way about it. Or if your sister is raped by an illegal migrant, you end up don't feeling that way about it. And I understand where you're coming from. I'm just saying to say, well, we don't really need to know who's coming in. We'll register them after they're here. Simply is idealistic, but it's also naive, because you end up getting a political reaction that calls out the worst in people. It calls out the worst in people that sit and beat on a 16-year-old kid who's fleeing his own horrors in Honduras. You know, that's my answer.
Ray, and make it quick because I want to get in as many comments and questions as I can. So.
Sure. Well, I appreciate your respect because this is a very hard topic to talk about, and your honesty is deeply appreciated. It goes both ways because these are very intense things to talk about. I would like to ask your opinion about how the vacuum of power in Mexico is sometimes convenient. Like this idea that institutions are needed to have an asylum system. Sometimes our country, for our location and precisely the fact that we're receiving migrants and we're also exporting them, and you mentioned crime, the vacuum of power in Mexico is... it's lucrative. It's convenient for certain groups. So could you please give
me... No. There's no question that the rule of law, this is goes back
to... I don't
to
know if you can make a Rodriguez,
well, you go back to the rule of law. Is the rule of law actually has to respond to that. You can't have violence of the kind that exists today. I know in my, you know, the other side of town for me is Tijuana. And that part of my town, of my community, is actually back at levels of violence that shouldn't be tolerated in a situation in which the rule of law governs. Oh my God, long
term. Sarah.
Why don't you gather some questions?
No? Okay. Well, let's, you know, it's the podcast. We're relaxed, so.
My question goes around the same line as Ray's question. I heard recently that Mexico has 97% of fatality rate in crimes that are actually reported. So, in your view, does the United States actually believe that Mexico has the ability to stop the migrants from crossing the country, and it goes along with the corruption levels?
Yeah. So 100 years ago, my country was more corrupt than Mexico is today. It was, and the rail, this is maybe 120 years ago. At the turn of the century, when Teddy Roosevelt, the progressive era in the United States, started to take on the corruption that it was caused by railroads and trusts and so on. Part of the democratization that Mexico is undergoing, and it's really a robust transformation, is it's got to confront the corruption issue, and it's got to confront the rule of law. And yes, there needs to be your generation. I would say that's the biggest challenge that you have. You cannot have impunity where the PGR doesn't bring people to justice. You can't have a situation where people become cynical about corruption. You have to change it. The United States did it by a combination of prosecution, publicity, democratic elections, and we still have corruption, but it's not systematic. It exists, but if you're caught at it, you go to jail for a very long time.
Yeah, go ahead.
But it's going to take 30 or 40 years. But you have to start.
So my question is whether the Trump administration has, well, President Trump has repeatedly stated that he's willing to go so far as to close the southern border. He has already said to the southern border. And my question goes along the lines as, does he have the legal authority to go that far? And if he does, will there be any political backlash?
So the answer is yes and yes. In 1985, Mexican authorities actually cooperated with the Guadalajara cartel to kill an American DEA agent named Enrique Camarena. The DEA and the Mexican government can equally be criticized for what happened to Camarena. But the fact of the matter is that the customs commissioner in those days, Von Raab, shut the border down for 3 days. And there was such an outcry that President Reagan actually directly ordered that stop. And the same would happen here. You cannot shut down the lifeblood of the American and Mexican economies. And in the same way that the Kansas farmers and the Nebraska farmers and the North Dakota farmers depended on realized how much they depended on the Mexican consumer, no va a pasar. So I would actually also just if I could give each of you un regalo para la Navidad, I would give you a book called Vanishing Frontiers. It's a book by Andrew Seeley that really shows how our countries have grown together. You know, this is not going to be so easy to pull us apart. And you can't just shut down the border. Again, I'm often wrong, but never uncertain. I'm not wrong here.
Why don't we try to focus questions on the issue of immigration, because that's where I want the podcast to be. So, yes.
Yeah, I would like to ask, you've said in a previous question that you find interesting like as a solution to look for mechanisms of international cooperation, and I find that interesting, but I think in the short term it isn't, you know, like something that could happen. I would like to ask you, like, with the past experiences we've had with the Syrian refugees in different countries, in the short term, what are the solutions that the US proposes? Because I find it really interesting to say, like, so international mechanisms will help in the long term, but the fact is that thousands of people are fleeing from a horrible situation, and a solution needs to be found, like, in the short term. What would the situation
so the let me just turn the question around though on you, because you're assuming that it's the U.S.'s situation, and I'm sharing with you my view that the Trump administration is not interested in addressing the real factors. Troops at the border, 100% prosecution of people crossing, birthright citizenship, National Guard at the border, those are all intended to generate a political response, not to actually solve the underlying problem. So my suggestion to you today was that don't look to the United States alone, but Mexico should be making, Mexico that is now deeply impacted by this situation, should actually take ownership, saying, here's a series of proposals that we make, whether it's the safe third country over time, or it's creating safe zones where migration officers can be trained. You can start to build a capacity building for Mexico in the context of a international administered, not run. This has got to be paid for by the United States, but it's got to be supported politically by Mexico and by Canada, and by the other countries of the hemisphere that want to take responsibility. But I wouldn't look to the United States. I think the only way in which we solve this issue is if Mexico says, look, this is impacting us. We're not prepared to have people wait in Mexico for their petitions to be adjudicated in the United States, but we will support having them in a safe zone in which they're protected, and in which they can claim asylum in the United States or Mexico in a protected fashion and with an expedited period of adjudication. But Mexico needs to actually then turn the policy debate around and say that would solve the problem, because if that kept the flows from coming and more caravans from coming, which I believe it would, how could the Trump administration turn it down?
Vladimir.
Well, first of all, thank you for sharing your ideas with us. And I would like to ask you, how do you think the rule of law can coincide with human rights in order to protect immigrant lives and their well-being?
So the rule of law would be give physical protection so that you're safe, fair and expedited proceedings so that, in fact, you get a decision in a reasonable time. And three, that there is a system that is genuinely capable of saying, here's a case that requires humanitarian relief. Here's a refugee case. And really what I've been proposing here today is the refugee standard of Syrians, affecting Syrians, and the asylum, they're basically the same legal process. The only difference is asylum is claimed inside a country, and refugee status is adjudicated outside the country. I think what I'm suggesting is that they be conflated and that they be treated the same and that everyone be dealt with as a refugee, and that would help you actually give relief to those who needed it, but not deal with the economic migration situation, which is not the province of the asylum system. But I'm with Rodrigo, and we then have to address the 40-year needs of development in Central America. That is critical, starting with safety. People have to be able to stay in their communities without having the kind of threats that exist. And while there's violence in Mexico, and I wouldn't discount that at all, it's a different level of violence than what's happening in communities in which innocent people are being regularly traumatized by violence in the Northern Triangle.
Really quick, if you can.
Yes, continue, because my question was directed what you just answered. But how can we treat such violence? Because it isn't like in the 40s, the mafias, which were really organized, were treated with disorganized crime. How can we, as an international community, deal with something that doesn't even has its own law?
Well, I happen to think that you could have a big impact. I've seen it in the course of my law enforcement career. If you go back in the 1980s to New York City with a crack cocaine epidemic, it was horrendous, and the violence was unbelievable. You have to address the issues, and it can't be, you want to do it with due process, and you have to respect the rule of law and people's rights, but you have to get tough. I mean, you really actually have to say, you shoot someone, you're going to go to jail. And you're going to go to jail for the rest of your life. You'd be surprised how that has an impact on people's behavior.
And you fill the prisons with like 3 million
more than 2 million. Part of the problem was the U.S. The U.S. filled the prisons with many people socioeconomically. There was much crime that was actually committed at that level. Got plenty of white people in the prisons. But the fact is that we weren't just putting, and my wife, who was in the Justice Department, is working on the smart on crime. We put far too many people in prison on drug cases, not on violence cases. I have no sympathy. You use a gun, you should go to, and you kill someone, you should go to jail and throw the key away. And maybe when you're 70 years old, you should be paroled. That's different from what happened, and I agree with you. Many, many, many people, in black and brown for the most part, were actually put in jail on drug cases that turned out to be a mistake that's being addressed now, even by conservatives in the United States, by the way. But okay, that's different from what we face in Central America and in many cities in Mexico today.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. No, thank you, Alan, for group. Coming to your town. Security Perimeter Podcast.